There is no massaging the data to fit your concept, but there is for other types of media. And I think that's one of the fundamental differences.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of Data Stories. My name is Moritz Stefaner and I'm an independent designer of data visualizations. In fact, I work as a self-employed truth and beauty operator out of my office here in the countryside in the north of Germany.
And I am Enrico Bertini. I am a professor at New York University in New York City, where I do research and teach data visualization.
That's right. And on this podcast, together, we talk about data visualization, data analysis, and generally the role data plays in our lives. And usually we do that together with a guest or two that we invite on the show.
Exactly. But before we start, just a quick note. Our podcast is listener supported, so there's no ads. And if you enjoy the show, please consider supporting us with recurring payments on patreon.com/datastories. Or you can also send us a one-time donation on paypal.me/datastories. And I just want to say, if you can do that, especially during these hard times, that's totally fine. Just keep listening to the show. And if you want to write maybe a message on Twitter talking about data stories, or maybe reviewing our show on iTunes, that would be really appreciated. Other than that, please don't feel obliged to do any donation.
Right, right. So let's dive right in. Let's get started. So we have a special topic today, and we decided to make it even a two-episode feature, maybe even more episodes to come, because actually there's been a huge blind spot. So Enrico and I, whenever we review our Trello board with episode ideas, we realize sometimes, oh, we've done so many episodes, but we never talked to somebody from Field X or from, you know, this and that area. And it's been like this really with small to medium data visualization agencies, which is insane, because some of the best data with work obviously comes from these types of companies. And we talk to a lot of practitioners and researchers and whatnot, but never really to people running data visualization studios. Huge blind spot happens, but now we're catching up quick. And so we're inviting two even guests today. And we record another episode with two more guests. And this will be the next one. So hopefully we're back to a good ratio of data with agency folks after all this, and keep going. And I'm personally super interested. I've known the folks we'll talk to you for many, many years. In fact, I realized last year at ENCODE conference that a lot of these agencies have been around for 10 years or longer. And so it's really now fascinating to hear a bit of their long-term perspective on how the field has evolved, how the field has changed, if there is even a viable business in making high-end crafted data visualization, or if we will all be unemployed soon. So I'm super curious to learn more about all this. So as I said, we have two guests. The first one is Thomas Clever. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Moritz. Hi, Enrico.
Thanks for joining us. And we have Benjamin Wiederkehr. Hi, Benjamin.
Hey, Ben.
Hi, Moritz. Hi, Enrico.
Great to have you on. So, Thomas, maybe first, could you briefly introduce yourself and your company? And then Benjamin can take over.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said, I'm Thomas Clever, or Clever, co-founder of Clever Franke, or Clever Frankie, as most people call us these days. We're a data design and technology company, and we create anything from, one-off data visualizations to data-driven products and tools, as we like to call it. Mm-hmm. We have our headquarters here in the Netherlands, and we have another office in Chicago and Dubai.
Yeah. How many people are working for you right now?
It's around 32, I think, if wow. I'm correct, 32 yeah. now.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Great. Benjamin, how about you?
All right. I'm an interaction designer with sort of like a focus on information visualization and interface design from the beginning. And then back in 2008, I started writing a blog on data visualization where I sort of like published my work and my research. That's also how we met Moritz. And I think also that's how I stumbled over Enrico's work.
Oh, yes.
And then sort of like a year later, I co-founded Interactive Things, which fairly similar to Clever Frankie, is a design and development studio with a focus on
data-driven products. We are a team of 17 people. We're sort of like a slightly weird beast as we are five equal partners in the company. Mm-hmm. And I think today sort of like my main focus is leading the company as the managing director. I have a few teaching assignments at universities on data visualization, and I'm sort of like co-organizing the Database Zurich meetup here in Zurich.
Right. So Benjamin, is there maybe, just so people get a sense of, okay, what types of projects do you like to do, or what's your approach? Is there maybe one quintessential project where you could say, okay, this is really quintessential, almost Interactive Things project, where you could say, yeah, that's sort of really good example of the type of work we do and we like to do?
Yeah, that's, you know, like picking your favorite child, right? So I think the project that sort of like comes to mind is actually two projects, and that's Education Inequalities and Education Progress. So these are two websites that we have built for UNESCO, and they are sister products in a way, even though they're 7 years apart. So Education Inequalities is already 7 years old now, and Education Progress was just released. The first was an exploratory tool analyzing disparities in quality of education. And the second is then an explanatory publication summarizing the key facts and trends. And so in a way, they present two coins of the data visualization, two sides of the data visualization coin, sort of like exploration for discovery and explanation for understanding. And besides being interesting from a data visualization perspective, I think the projects also rank very high in sort of like our view because of the purpose. They both advance the Sustainable Development Goal 4 forward, which I think is an important aspect. So inclusive and equitable quality of education for all. The second is the client, UNESCO, has been a long-term and very, very committed client to the success of each of their projects. And then in terms of craft, we're both challenged in design and development when we work on these projects. And typically with UNESCO, we are allowed to pursue a very iterative process instead of sort of like, you know, fixed scope, waterfall type of process. And I think sort of like these three aspects or four aspects, purpose, client, craft, and process are important to us. And I think they are well reflected in those two projects.
Great. Thomas, how about you? Is there a similar example?
Yeah, like Ben said, that's always very hard. And I think if you look back over the years that we've been running the business, there's always some, you know, quintessential projects, some lighthouse projects that I think really define you as a company to take a next step in where you are. You know, if I have to choose, then I think the mobility index website that we created for the Chicago Metropolitan Agency of Planning is one of my personal favorites, really because it brings together a lot of things dear to my heart and dear to our company's heart, in the sense that it's a mix of experimental data viz with an important message behind it. The CMAP approached us because they had written a new mobility plan, or a new urban planning plan, so to speak, for the city of Chicago, which was pretty much the first comprehensive urban planning plan since Daniel Burnham, which was about 100 years ago. And it really outlined around economy, mobility, and livability where the city should be heading, and also the challenges that they face. So mobility is a very important topic to the city of Chicago. I think 25% of the workforce is somehow tied to freight, transportation, all those type of things. And, you know, the investment that needs to be done in the infrastructure there is about $13 trillion. Mm-hmm. And to really convey that message, they asked us, can you concise the, or can you digest this plan of 660 pages into one interactive website? And of course, we said yes, remembering that on the way there on the plane, I was reading through that plan and thinking, I'm not sure how we're going to do it. But it was really, it's a really nice project in how we did a lot of editorial stuff on you know, understanding the plan and thinking, how can we explain this plan to, you know, anybody down in the street, but also to business policy makers, journalists, politicians. And there's a whole editorial sort of structure that there, you know, there's a bird's eye view over Chicago. And then as you dive into the topics, you literally dive down into street level. There's different types of visualizations, from charts to, you know, we were using new technologies at the time. This was 2014. So yeah, a lot of boxes that are ticked in that project. And I think, you know, looking back, I just realized when I heard Ben talk that that was the first time that we set foot in Chicago, and mm-hmm. here we are six, 7 years later.
On the
and
international map, in a way, right?
Here we have the office in Chicago. So really, it's also the the moment in time I fell in love with that city.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
One thing I was wondering if you can briefly describe how is an agency like yours different from other ways of organizing business around data visualization? So I'm thinking about in-house data visualizers or freelancers, or even more classic web agency.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have to admit that, you know, I founded this company together with my business partner, Gert, when we were still in university. So, of course we did some internships, but never worked at a company. We've always been our own boss. So I have to admit that is a side note I should make. But if I look at, you know, other design agencies, other web agencies, those type of companies, and of course people that have joined us over the years, I think there are, you know, we might be 90-95% the same. I think in terms of, you know, the complexity of the work is where I think it is a little bit different. I'm not saying one is better than the other, don't get me wrong, but I think when you look at the type of clients and the type of challenges that they throw at us, it's very much at the intersection of data strategy and business. And business can also be an organization like, you know, a UNESCO, like Ben mentioned, but there are goals there, and these are all sort of we're trying to marry those and really understand what is this business, what is the core of their challenge. And once we get to that core, either through data or with data, that's when you build up the product and start thinking about, you know, the users, the stakeholders and all those type of things. So there's a delicate balance in the projects that we work on, from a business perspective. Then of course there's the data, which is, you know, we use data the way that another design agency might use photography or music or film or cinematography. But data has, of course, some inherent challenges with it as well. Data quality, privacy, you know, that we can go on. There's multiple podcasts in that. but I think, you know, really that complexity is what you really have to digest and understand. And both from a technical and a design perspective.
Feel you have to rewind in terms of a client says, I need a 3D animated map. And you go back to, great. Let's pause for a second there. Let's keep that in mind. But like, what are you trying to achieve? Or like, what's your product actually looking like? Or who are we talking to?
Yeah, that's absolutely. And I think, thankfully, I've only had the question of a 3D bar chart once in my life. And I did design it just to prove them wrong. but other than that, there's a lot of focus in our work on just understanding the challenge, the landscape that this has to work in, has to operate in, and also I think, you know, looking at the design and technology people that work in our company, I think we attract different type of designers and technologists than, let's say, you would at an ad agency. I mean, you're not going to see our work out in the open in like this train station per se on big billboards, right? It's very often a different type of project. Mm-hmm. So, curious to see how Ben would think about this.
No, I mean, I share, on the one hand side, I share the same caveat. I've never worked in another design agencies and therefore sort of like don't really have the inside scoop there. And I agree with the things that you've mentioned of the complexity of working in sort of like on data intensive products and also the non-linearity of sort of like the development process. There simply isn't really a chance of conceptual work, design work, development work, what you would typically or what you would have traditionally found in application development or sort of like website development. So the notion of a cross-functional team having to continually and iteratively working together, I think, like, just is an inherent part of how such a data design agency works. That's also something that we had to learn. There is simply no other way. And similarly, to the point that sort of like Moritz mentioned, educating the client on how this work happens, the idea of sort of like dropping a CSV file on our doorstep and expecting an award-winning experience sort of like 6 weeks after to be picked up is something that like might still exist in fantasies, but is just not part of the reality. And so, also understanding that this sort of like intensive work and nonlinear work involves like many different stakeholders. And that's sort of like the data provider, that's the product owner, these are the end users, these are the domain experts. And so it is definitely working as a client with an agency is definitely more hands-on than they might typically expect from working with a web design agency or a branding agency or a marketing agency. And I don't want to, again, sort of like, I don't have the inside scoop into how these agencies function. Maybe they're exactly the same level of sort of like hands-on, knees-deep in the client's materials. And for them, it's just videos or textual content or imagery. And for us, it's just their sort of like raw data, and that might be the case, right? But that I think is something that might be a sort of like a misunderstanding of like, you know, input data and output visually like output sort of like data driven experience, and that's just not sort of like a hands off situation.
Yeah, and this whole idea of data as a third stakeholder that Martin Wattenberg, I think, and Fernanda Viegas brought into the game is, I think, such a nice one that you say, okay, they are clients and they are designers, but there's also data as an invisible third stakeholder at the table, and data has rights too and interests and preferences maybe or affordances. And I think at VIST there was also this paper, Data Changes Everything, Enrico, or yes. Was it published last year at VIST, that also argued that data design is fundamentally different from other forms of design.
To me, the material is not as malleable as it is for like working with video, working with images, because like you might be able to sort of like change the angle, reshoot the scene, rewrite the text. There is no sort of like, or I mean, I hope there is no massaging the data to fit your concept.
Yeah. No, we wouldn't do
that. But there is for other types of media. And I think that's one of the fundamental differences where we do have to follow the constraints that sort of like come with whatever the data is. And oftentimes you don't know what the data is. Oftentimes, you know, you work with a dynamic data source and you can't even expect to understand what the data will look like at all times over the lifecycle of a product, right? You might have a demo data set to start with. You might have sort of like a snapshot of now, but oftentimes the product gets connected to data that will be refreshed, and then things will look different. And sort of like you have to design for eventualities that are not under control in maybe during the creation process.
Right. Yeah. I have a practical question. So to me, it seems, and this might be a total misperception, but or maybe a systemic bias we have in the field, but it seems like a lot of the successful data visualization work that gets a lot of visibility like at awards or in, you know, in on Twitter or something is often done by individuals or small teams. And I was wondering, what's your experience with scaling data visualization productions? Like, can you scale it to, like, is it easy to separate the work so you can work with 5 people on one data visualization product or even with 10? Or is there like a natural limit where this tight collaboration between data and design and technology and consulting breaks down? Did you find maybe a formula that makes it easier to divide the work and have really clearly defined interfaces? Or do you have a lot of small teams that all do little projects? Like, how did you deal with this whole practical issue of scaling up data visualization design and production?
That's a good question. I don't think we ever thought about scaling up data visualization design in that sense. So that's an interesting thing.
But you have like
thing.
32 people like working. So do they all work on individual projects, or how many people would usually work on a project?
That's a good question. I think, you know, we have multiple projects running at the same time in the studio. Those are a combination of larger and smaller projects. But I think, you know, looking at an ideal team setup for us, I think, you know, you're looking at around 6 to 8 people on a larger project. That's when, you know, going above those numbers, people start to get in each other's way. At the same time, that's sort of the number that our team really collaborates with each other. So it really is an important collaboration. Of course, there are smaller projects that maybe 1 or 2 people might work on. But if you look at sort of the scaling and the larger projects, that's for us an ideal size. And often I think a lot of our clients are surprised. They would even say that our team is small on a project. Because very often big IT firms are working with 20, 30, 40 people on something. And here we come in with 8, and they sort of look at you and think, are you sure you can manage? But really it's about efficiency and just having a team that trusts each other and knows exactly where each other's skill set lies. I think that is the optimum size. And that's, I guess, 2, 3, 4 type projects that you have at the same time the studio. Typically, our developers like to work on projects for a longer period of time in one stretch, whereas designers by nature get bored quicker. Mm-hmm. So they want to have maybe 2
projects.
So you're
playing a lot of Tetris with big pieces and small pieces and try to fit everything together. Yeah. Benjamin, how about you? I know you have put a lot of thought into your process and your culture at Interactive Things.
So fundamentally, I think, again, it's very similar to what Thomas just said. There are multiple projects sort of like running in parallel at the studio at all times, of different sizes. And I think like that's healthy and for us, definitely the natural state of work now. The individual project teams for us are typically slightly smaller. So I think we consider more of sort of like 4 to a maximum of 6 people to work well for us. Maybe also to work well for the type of products that we're producing. I think, of course, like depending on for who you work, what the product needs to look like and how quickly it has to be delivered. Like those are all factors that define the project team. But in general, we sort of like form these project teams that are then dedicated to sort of like working on an individual product. They are typically cross-functional. So it's, designers with a variety of skills, it's developers with a variety of skills working together. We try our best to keep those cross-functional teams all together from start through execution to the end. There's always work to do for everyone, which is sort of like a slight shift from how we thought work would happen at the beginning. So over time, like that is definitely one of the learnings and something that we try to make our principal way of working in this type of project. As a result, scaling up, I could see scaling up working like self-organized teams. So if you, I don't think that it makes sense to scale up, at least for the type of projects that we do, to scale up the teams to like, you know, double or triple the size that I just mentioned. But that doesn't necessarily mean that an agency of Clever Frankie's size, for example, like doesn't work in my perspective. Like that might, I mean, you mentioned it, you're sort of like a little bit beyond 30 people. So I could see that scaling, and then you have a higher throughput of projects, but sort of like the individual project team size per project is roughly the same. And I think if you look towards the principle of sort of like self-organized teams and self-organized organizations, like Teal and all of these buzzwords, then I think that's also reflected in their thinking. Like, don't try to instantiate too big of a division of labor. Like, don't build up silos, and then don't try to centralize functions, or don't have too many centralized functions. Instead, embed those into the individual teams. And then an organization should be fairly flexible in scaling or contracting. But again, that's just theory. I don't really have a have practical experience with that. Yeah. I'm not sure that I'm interested in earning that. But the area of self-organization in teams is definitely something that I think is interesting. And on this very small scale here at Interactive Things, that's something that we try to pursue.
I think you're absolutely right, Ben. I think the scaling is definitely in terms of more project teams next to each other rather than ramping up the size of an individual project team. I see absolutely no benefit in creating a project team of 15 people. So yeah, I think, you know, this, the self-steering teams and all those type of, things are definitely, something that really work well, in this situation.
Maybe one note that I, because Moritz sort of like opened the question with, you know, successful work is done by individuals or sort of like very small teams. And I think there's one thing that I'm observing, which is a slight glorification of the unicorn visualizer in our field. Right. So people who excel at all involved disciplines and sort of like can take a raw data set and turn it into a keystone experience. Present company, looking over to you, Moritz, is a slight point in case. And I think this is great, but I think this does also have parallels to the web design industry, where sort of like the unicorn designer is somebody who does everything well, from user research through pixel perfect design to, like, you know, front end development across platforms. And I think this could sort of like raise slightly unrealistic expectations for employers who are looking for this type of people, or overwhelming feelings of inadequacy for newcomers. I think there is a big role to play for someone who's just extremely good at front-end engineering, or who's extremely good at information visualization, but doesn't have the other skills. And I just hope that we don't get disillusioned if I'm sort of like fairly narrow in my skill set. I will never have a chance in database because all the award-winning projects are done by these, again, by these unicorns who like can do it all. And I think that's something that we just, in order to keep it inclusive for people who like just don't have the bandwidth, don't have the time to sort of like learn all of these things, that there's still place to do work in that, in our field.
Also, I think this type of unicorn approach, as you call it, also works just for a certain type of project. So if you really want to build lasting tools that are used over a long period of time and that are like really integrated with people's work, you have to be a good team player. You know, there's no way you can just do this in this hit and run fashion and just, you know, take that CSV to make it beautiful and off you go. You know, that's not really sustainable in an applied setting, right?
I think you see it even more, not just in our field of work, so to speak, but even in looking at job vacancies from technology companies or just businesses looking for design talent. You sometimes see this list of, you know, must be skilled in everything called Adobe, but then also have front-end coding skills, and you know, even myself, I think, well, I can't do that. What is happening here? So, I think it's a very valuable point that Ben makes here about you know, the talent and people looking to go into DataViz is, you know, you shouldn't feel ashamed that you're not that unicorn. There is a space for, there's a place for everyone.
There's space for donkeys and horses and everything.
Exactly.
And I'm curious about something here. So when you assemble a new team, I guess it's always a mix of designers and developers, right? So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about how do you carefully assemble a new team and maybe even how you hire new people. I guess designers and coders don't necessarily always go very well together. So I'm wondering if you have any insights on that.
I think that, I mean, I get the point and sort of like the trope of designers and coders don't going well together, but like I would just love to just completely dismiss this notion.
Perfect.
Because they do. Like
these
are people who are like making, building, creating things. they're building products. And yes, for some the tools is JavaScript. For some, the tools is Go. For some, the tools is Python. For others, the tools is Sketch. And for yet others, the tool is Tableau. So yes, the tools change. And I mean, it could be said that sort of like a designer's mindset is slightly different from sort of like a programmer's mindset. But at the end of the day, sort of like we're confronted with a series of challenges. There are methods that we apply to overcome these challenges and sort of like find the solutions to problems. And at the end of the day, we sort of like see a progression in, at the beginning, there was nothing. And at the end, there's going to be a product. And sort of like you just continually evolve this thing until it's done or good enough or award winning. And if you assemble a team that I think believes in each other's responsibilities and also believes in each other's strengths, then it doesn't necessarily matter if they consider themselves to be a designer or an engineer or a hybrid somewhere in between. And to me, that is always one of the most important aspects in our hiring. Like one of the big areas that we want to explore with a potential hire is like what their perspective on collaboration, communication, and community is, to learn how they see themselves. And I think, maybe then I'm in the privileged position to make a pick and therefore have people on our team that where I don't even have this conflict of, that person doesn't really go well with like a very creative, very experimental designer. So of course, there's a curation. So I have this slight distorted view. If I just took a general population of designers and developers, then yes, the curation would have to happen on a per project basis. But in the lucky situation of having a steady team, I don't have to make this curation. And we sort of like establish a common understanding and a common respect between all the people as a fundament. And then per project, it's not really a question of curating the team.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that ties in well with how we look at hiring people. And of course, there are discussions within the studio between designers, programmers, developers, but also among designers themselves and developers themselves. I mean, in the end, our team is passionate and a lot of passionate individuals. So, you know, there's also discussions going on between interaction designers and visual designers about the styling of a button, whether it's ugly or not. And it is fundamental discussions like that go on. And at the same time, like Ben said, I think a lot of people that work in our types of companies and, you know, in DataViz are often this hybrid or multi-skilled individuals that have this interest in technology and design. So very often I joke that we have the design nerds and the nerd designers in our company. and really we hire on culture, on cultural fit, more than talent and skill set, because I'm a firm believer on, you know, educating people on certain things. Of course, you need to have some fundamental form of talent for either design or code. But a lot of things you can learn on the job, and we train people in that. But things that you can't learn are just, having trust in your colleagues, working together. And really one of the fundamental questions I ask in any job interview to myself is, could I sit next to this person in an airplane for 4 hours? And, you know, 4 hours is just long enough to start getting sweaty and annoyed and uncomfortable. And, you know, are you happy with the person sitting next to you at that moment in time? Are you going to have a good conversation? And it's a very good test for yourself to think about, you know, does this person fit into our company? And that doesn't mean that people have to be the same. On the contrary, I want to have as many different people in our company working together. But there needs to be this fundamental respect and trust for each other and for each other's capabilities, whether you're junior or senior, you know, all these things. I mean, sometimes, you know, a junior designer can tell me, Thomas, I don't like the typeface that you're using. That's absolutely fine.
That's the type of people you want around, right?
Yeah, exactly. <By the way. laughs> So really, it's much more about culture than I feel about other things.
Yeah, I'm sure it's an ongoing struggle and challenge, but also exciting to build these teams and figure out what works, what doesn't. And then you think you have figured it out, and 2 weeks later, things look totally different.
It's an eternal struggle, Moritz.
Exactly. Yeah. I can imagine it's exciting. Yeah, I want to use the opportunity now that I have you two here in the call also to talk a bit about the long-term view of how the whole Dataviz field has changed. Like, you've been following, you know, your own, now, you know, we've been following your careers, but you've also followed the development of the field and how things have changed. So my question here was, like, do you see any, can you say there have been shifts in how over the last 10 years, maybe client requirements have changed, what types of projects were feasible or interesting to do, or, is it all pretty much still the same, but we have just fancier technologies, you know? Or do you feel like that the whole field is sort of, yeah, evolving in certain directions? I would be super curious here to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think the field is definitely evolving. When we started our company, you know, you saw even in data sets that were thrown at you, it was very much about web analytics and those type of data sets. And then it went into financial data. And then, you know, as you, then the iPhone was introduced, which was a huge, you know, improvement on one hand regarding Dataviz going from B2B to B2C space. And I think from our perspective, and I think where we see our value add in the years to come is really around data, physical, digital space, IoT, sensor technology, and how visualization plays a role in interfaces, adaptive interfaces moreover, because I think, you know, we're now...
Real-time data as well, probably, like this constant handling of data
absolutely.
Streams.
I think, you know, we're heading towards a world where you design and develop something that you don't know how that is going to be used across all these different platforms and touch points and areas and fields. So you're really designing much more a system, and it requires a systemic approach to design and to Dataviz. More than anything. So that's where I see the long-term view for us is really those adaptive interfaces and systems that are much larger than just a single visualization. And also, I think maybe even going as far as questioning whether we should visualize data in future whether, you know, we should actually be helping people in such a way that they don't need to look at data, which is, I think, an interesting philosophical question that we have discussions about quite often in our studios. You know, how can you, how would you design a data visualization for voice control, right? Without any screen, those type of things. There's a huge sort of green field for us to explore.
Benjamin, how about you?
Yeah, again, I'm definitely following Thomas's sort of like train of thought here. We have seen over the past like 10 years, where we have been working actively in the field, huge shifts, first and foremost, in like understanding what the value is of the work that we're doing. So even understanding like the value of using data in more aspects than sort of like, you know, analytics, sort of like data prone fields that have been working with data for decades before. And instead, I think that's reflective when Thomas says, we have seen new data sets, like maybe things were analytics sets before and then financial sets, because these are traditional industries that have been working with data for a long time. But now we see consumers working with data much more. We see journalists working with data much more. We see educators working with data. People who have to report on their data, switching from sort of like interpretations in written form to more exploratory experience. So I think all this new data that we get to work with is a result of more diverse people working actively with data and don't necessarily do all the interpretation and transmission into the spoken word again, but instead allow their stakeholders to sort of like actively still explore and experiment with the data. And I think that's that has been a huge change.
And suddenly it's all about digital transformation in general, rather than making in a pie way, or a bubble chart, right?
Yeah. Right. We started right sort of like after the financial crisis before and sort of like, you know, slightly after the coin of sort of like data is the new oil, the term data is the new oil was coined. And so at the beginning, we definitely had to explain much more the type of work that we do. And again, the benefits of working with data these days, this is like everybody's understanding in almost all industries. And so it's much less of this explanation of sort of like what type of work this is and why this is important and what can be the benefits. It's we start much later sort of like in this education process whenever we talk to clients. And I think that will definitely continue to shift. I think we have, again, like there's a mass market for data visualizations now. But I think that also poses the next challenges because I think we also have reached a certain level of the audience that definitely now have a much higher data literacy or data visualization literacy, but there's still much more ground to be covered. And maybe, as Thomas says, maybe visualization is not necessarily the right medium anymore. So if we look at trends like I want answers instead of I want to analyze. I want to have something personalized instead of I want to have something generic. I want to have something that's quick, snackable, and consumable instead of sort of like this long form. So these shifts in consumer behavior and how we consume information in general, I think point in the direction of where work, sort of like of where I think human data interaction will go. And the visual media like is extremely powerful. It is also exclusive. So it also excludes people with certain disabilities to even start interacting with data. And so I think not as a, you know, not as a fallback, but instead of taking the human data as the actual norm and then thinking, is visualization the right medium or is yet another type of medium more adequate going forward, I think is something that's very, very interesting. So
I think, Ben, you touch upon a really important point, which is data literacy. And maybe that is an something that our field is should consider is the on the one hand, we have the data literate people, and on the other hand, we have the data illiterate people. And I think, you know, looking at maybe a broader trend, and you replace words like data with digital, it becomes, where the new rich and poor split divide comes, right? Are you digitally literate or illiterate? Are you able to manifest yourself in a digitized society that is throwing all these data and insights at you or not? And I think companies like ours also have, on the one hand, progressing the data literate people to a new level, but at the same time, taking those data illiterate people or the ones that don't have the tools and means to access that and help them advance to that same level, to that equal playing field. And I think, you know, there's often in the tech world and the world that we operate in, we talk about, you know, everything is being digitized, but let's not forget that at least 50% of this globe is still people are fighting for shelter, for safety, and some kind of running water. They don't really care about data visualization at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And still we can design and develop the tools for them, to come up to that level very quickly, I hope.
Yeah. And that's a great, like, general observation, that this designing more for a fit for a certain audience, or to think of all the different types of audiences and also the different types of formats and channels. I think there the awareness in the last few years has really risen. And I think maybe 5 to 10 years back, we would have thought more in a one-size-fits-all approach, or like, let's just make a cool project and everybody will see it, right? And so,
yeah, I think it's a natural progression, right? As you said, 10 years ago, like, okay, we can make a visualization. We might use Flash, like people might need a plugin, but we can't create a visualization. Nope. Then, okay, we can create a visualization that's web native. Yeah. Then, okay, we can create a visualization that can also be seen on a smarter device. Then we create visualizations that sort of like go across devices. And I think going forward, it's like, maybe the visualization is not the necessary sort of like or the most important part anymore, but the interaction with the data, like learning about the data, understanding the data, analyzing it, taking insights from it, making it actionable, and so forth. Like, that's the important part. And I think that's sort of like where a lot of, as Thomas says, a lot of green field still is. And I think that's where we should be pushing forward into.
Yeah. And this job never stops, regardless of technology shifts or, you know, whatever. I think we can still do that in 30 years.
In the end, I'm thinking that the basic skills and principles behind communicating data don't really go away once you change a medium or channel, right? So I would be really curious to see what happens when we more people start going away, in a way, from visualization and using other channels. That's super interesting.
Yeah, great stuff.
So
we need to wrap up soon. But we have one more, like, special idea.
So we want to end these episodes with having Benjamin ask a question to Thomas, and Thomas ask a question to Benjamin.
All right. So I think I tie directly into the last few statements that Thomas made. Thomas, Sensor Lab, what is it all about and why?
Great question. Sensor Lab is a nonprofit that we started when we moved into our new office space here about 2.5-3 years ago. And you know, we have this prototyping lab within Clever Franca, where we, you know, it has anything from drills to, you know, soldering machines to, you know, all the nerd stuff that you always want as a kid. So finally we had the space and we felt let's build this prototyping lab where we can just go wild on anything. But like most things in life, that stands idle for 90-95% of the time. So, that's a shame. You know, like owning a car, you don't use it very often if you think about it. So that's why we said, hey, why don't we consolidate that into what we call Sensor Lab and open it up for students and people that want to come use our equipment and use our tools and you know, hopefully this the odd intern or the odd employee walks out at the same time or walks in, I should say, and then walks out as an employee. But so that's really what Sensor Lab is about. It's nothing. It's not a different company or anything, but it's something that we promote separately. And it's a little bit bigger than just the prototyping lab. We also have an event space in our office that we host, you know, presentations and those type of things. So we have university students coming in and learning about data visualization. We have created this workshop that is a very small introductory workshop, 3 to 4 hours for students to learn how to connect a muscle sensor to an interface and get the data in a JSON file and how to structure it and then create their own visualizations out of it. So really it's fun and games, so to speak, but in a structured way that makes business sense in some way, shape or form.
Awesome. Excellent. Sounds like fun.
Yeah, so I mean, this like Ben said, his question ties into the last part. Mine ties into maybe the things that we talked about earlier, and you know, not having the experience of working in another agency like you, there are always things that you want to learn from each other and see how you deal with challenges. So you mentioned that you know you work with these multi-skilled teams, 4 to 6 people, and you run into this, you know, during a data vis process, you switch from analysis to design to development to narrator back to analysis to find the best angle and way forward to bring this message across. How do you switch perspectives at the right time within your team? Mm-hmm. And I ask that because that's a constant challenge on our end always.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I think that applies to both interdisciplinary teams, but that also applies to an individual who would just sort of like execute a project from start to finish on their own. Because you do have to like put on different hats or sort of like put on different glasses to have a different perspective and focus on what's relevant at that time. So, I mean, one sort of like tool that helped us set this mindset, depending on the project phase, is something that we sort of like started a few years ago. We have in our office for each project, we have project boards, very similar to how other companies work with Kanban boards or a similar system. And on our project boards, we have sort of like a few different templates for different stages that the project is in. And besides having things like a timeline and a list of, you know, requirements or a list of assumptions, and then sort of like a Kanban board for our tools, we also have a big sheet where we have our mindset written on it. So in sort of like written out English, we write what is our current mindset that we operate under in this phase of the project. And that sort of like evolves over time. And so in a way, it acts as a token, it acts as a reminder. It takes the it again, sort of like it's something that you can point to. It's something that you, because you have it in daily stand-up meetings or in also in larger discussions, that you can sort of like point to and say, hey, let's not forget. Where, you know, we try to explore different options. So it's not necessarily the point in time to sort of like cut out everything that's bad and only pursue sort of like one direction. Or conversely, hey, now is not the time for more exploration. Now is sort of like refinement and polishing. And so these things written out in physical space, if you work in a physical space or written out in a digital space for a team is a very helpful token for not forgetting it as the project leader yourself, but also having everybody sort of like be able to point to it and then actually actively using it in discussions and in their work. So that's something that helped us.
Great. Thank you. That's awesome. Super inspiring. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are physical, like big cardboards, and you can pin stuff on them, and everybody could see where a project's at a given point in time.
Yeah. So there is it's sort of like a predefined format of a cardboard wall. Yeah. It really is fairly big, but still like small enough to handle yourself. Mm-hmm. Peter Gossner, one of the partners at Interactive, he wrote a lengthy blog post about the thinking behind it. It's also like, it has been sort of like a few years in the making until we're where we are. Yeah. And it's an evolving thing. So like these things change. And right now we're sort of like trying to move away also in the current situation, trying to move away from the physical necessity to like have the board in the room, to have an equivalent in the digital space that is a little bit more portable and sort of like allows for a little bit more remote access. So I'm happy to send that link where sort of like we explain how they really look and work.
Yeah, we want that blog post. We want to see a photo of all these boards.
Yeah, we're experimenting with something in the digital space, like you said, having those project boards or even doing sprint retos online because everyone is working remote now.
Exactly. And
we found that Miro is a very nice tool to use and also to have workshops with clients at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, anything that allows like this effortless awareness of where everybody's at and what the reading the room has become so much harder, right? When everybody is remote. And so this is an interesting time to figure out things to create this this type of awareness over a distance. Yeah, but I totally agree. All these physical things that you can point to and like discuss together can be so valuable in building up that mutual and this common ground between people and say like, yeah, we're doing the same thing here and this is where we are. And it sounds trivial, but it's very important. Yeah. Wonderful. That was great chatting to you. We should wrap it up. Otherwise, we're losing too many people who don't have so much time to listen. But if you have any additional questions, you can ping Thomas and Benjamin on Twitter for sure or some other social platform or send us an email and we'll respond maybe. And we'll link to your stuff, take a look at the show notes, and super looking forward to seeing what you'll come up with in the future in terms of projects. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Has been an absolute privilege and joy.
Oh. Absolutely. I concur.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey folks, thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, a few last notes. This show is crowdfunded and you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/datastories, where we publish monthly previews of upcoming episodes for our supporters. Or you can also send us a one-time donation via PayPal at paypal.me/datastories.
Or as a free way to support the show, if you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be very helpful as well. And here's some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, so follow us there for the latest updates. We have also a Slack channel where you can chat with us directly. And to sign up, go to our homepage at datastory.es, and there you'll find a button at the bottom of the page.
And there you can also subscribe to our email newsletter if you want to get news directly into your inbox and be notified whenever we publish a new episode.
That's right. And we love to get in touch with our listeners. So let us know if you want to suggest a way to improve the show or know any amazing people you want us to invite or even have any project you want us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't hesitate to get in touch. Just send us an email at mail@datastory.es.
That's all for now. Hear you next time. And thanks for listening to Data Stories.